or at least they have reason to acquiesce to you, because otherwise you will say, well, you do what I say or I'm going to kill your son here. So again, it was a matter of control. But what we're recognizing, or we should recognize here, is that this is an indication that Antiochus was scheming, manipulating to gain power and secure the throne for himself. It was not rightfully his, but he saw an opening to grab it, and he did. And it also tells us something about the fact that he had some great ambitions for himself at just about anyone else's expense. So, hence, we are not surprised that we might recognize him as a despicable or vile person. Then, looking at verses 22 to 24, we read, "With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people." Now, there's that recognition there of acting deceitfully. That's not by mistake. That's recognized. "He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time." So again, we need to figure out, okay, what are we talking about here? Well, the first thing we want to acknowledge is this new king will be characterized by deceit. That is certainly the case. Antiochus IV will aggressively resist the king of the south. He would be, or as we look back from our historical perspective, he was successful in battle against the Egyptians, that is Ptolemy the VI at this time, for a time. And the verse indicates a strong force of conflict with the force of a flood, or with arms of a torrent, literally. He was up against Ptolemy the VI. And the way that Antiochus worked with or dealt with him was he first deceived him and then he defeated him. It was sort of his policy to throw off his victim, if you want to call it that, throw them off guard by offering them his friendship and his alliance, like he's, "I'm going to work with you," and then he maneuvers himself into an advantageous position where he can catch them by surprise. And of course, this only works so long until people start catching on to it, which they usually do eventually. But it's also interesting that this was a similar strategy that is used by Antichrist, looking back to Daniel 9:27, and looking into the New Testament as well. Here we also see that Antiochus swept away the Jewish high priest, Onias III, where it talks about the prince of the covenant. That's who is referenced there. This was about 172 B.C., some have tried to suggest, well, maybe the prince of the covenant here is Ptolemy the VI, because Antiochus later made a treaty with him. But the reference to covenant in this chapter seems to be more specifically referring to the Jewish state. And so it seems most logical, given the circumstances, as we'll see in a moment, that this is related to the manipulation or moving Onias, the Jewish high priest, out of his position for someone else to take over. Then there's the mention of a league that probably refers to an alliance between Antiochus IV made with Ptolemy the VI in 170 BC. Again, looking at verses 23 and 24. So this treaty was part of a plot to advance his own power in Egypt by siding with Ptolemy the VI, that's of Egypt, against his rival for the Egyptian throne. So it looks like he's manipulating or moving to show, like, "I'm on your side as long as I can get something advantageous from it." So he used it, again, to gain strength, using his smaller forces at the time, making a movement toward an alliance, and then taking advantage of the benefit of that. So then he goes back home, that is to Syria, that is in Antiochus, and then he pillages some of the treasures of his own province, but he's not doing it to gain for himself, directly. He's doing it so that he can use the treasures that he gets to bribe and to manipulate other leaders in order to get them to cooperate with him. So again, he is manipulating things for his particular advantage. And again, we can see the parallels between his mode of operation and that which is going to be typical of the Antichrist who is to come. Then looking at verses 25 to 27, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, that's Egypt, with a great army. And the king of the south, that's Ptolemy the fourth, I mean the sixth, shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, and he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacy shall destroy him, his army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. So here, I want to identify this as the conflict between the north and the south, that is, Syria and Egypt, will continue. After Antiochus had grown strong enough, he marched his army against Ptolemy the sixth. This was in 170 B.C. This was a part of his first formal campaign against Egypt. And he was able to get all the way down to the delta of the Nile before the Egyptians discovered that he was approaching. So he had some good stealth to be able to get there without being detected initially. And for a time, he exercised a significant amount of influence over Egypt. He was pretending to be an ally, and then he was again using his enemy for his own advantage. And we noticed how the text highlights, again, the deceptiveness and the manipulation of Antiochus. And we are not then surprised to see why he is so pinpointed and focused on as a forerunner to the future Antichrist. Also, there is some internal opposition to Ptolemy. Those who ate Ptolemy's choice food are noted here. Those are the ones that should have supported him, and they are the ones who actually plotted to destroy him. So eventually, his army suffered defeat, and many of his soldiers died. 1 Maccabees 1, 16 to 19 of the Apocrypha talk about that. There's a lot of historical information of this time period that's dealt with in the books of the Maccabees in the Apocrypha. And so there is some benefit from looking at those as far as the historical significance. The battle was successful in part because Antiochus claimed to be fighting for Ptolemy against a usurper in Egypt. When the battle was over, then Antiochus and Ptolemy sat down together at a banquet, and they were giving the impression that they were wanting peace. Of course, they were each trying to get what they could get for their own particular advantage and benefit. And again, we see again more evidence of deceit and manipulation. And our response to that is, who would have thought that you might not be able to trust all politicians? We've been there. Then a pattern of disregard expands. Looking at verses 28 and 29, while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant. That's going to have formal implications there. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. Then continuing verses 30 and 31, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Now you can see that the Holy Covenant is used in somewhat of a technical sense here. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily sacrifices and the place there, and place there the abomination of desolation. Now, we've heard that terminology before. Another nation will increasingly be violated. So the northern kingdom, Syria, had been battling for several years through many different kings with Egypt. Often, Israel being in the middle was sort of the football that was being tossed back and forth politically. And so that is now going to be another change of focus here. So the attention of Antiochus will shift from Egypt to Israel. So as a result of this sort of peace conference with Ptolemy, Antiochus returned home from Egypt with a significant amount of plunder, things that he had gained in the process of his manipulation there. Then his interest turned from Egypt to Israel, where he already exercised a considerable amount of control. But what happened here was there was a Jew by the name of Jason who wanted to be the high priest. And I don't recall what his rationale was, but that's what he was interested in, probably a political benefit from that. But knowing Antiochus's reputation, that he was a manipulator and perhaps could be manipulated, Jason offered the king a bribe to depose the current high priest, Ananias III, as we'd referenced before. Then Antiochus cooperated, and then in the process, that encouraged another pretender who was interested in the priesthood, Menelaus, to use the same tactic against Jason. Well, Antiochus cooperated again. He said, well, if you're going to give me bribes, I'll go along with that. I'll get some benefit out of this. I don't care who's running things here as long as it's to my benefit. So in the process, Ananias III, the high priest that was appreciated by the Jews, who was the rightful one, he objected to what was going on. He lost his life in the process. Then Antiochus executed certain individuals for their alleged roles in these maneuverings, but he didn't punish Jason or Menelaus, but instead he scapegoated the people of Jerusalem, again in response to bribes. So after Jason attempted to take over, thinking that Antiochus was dead, then Antiochus entered Jerusalem with his army, and he slew 80,000 men. So that was a pretty major catastrophe, to say the least. And then, accompanied by Menelaus, he desecrated the temple, and this was in 168 B.C. And so the reference here to the Holy Covenant refers to the Law of the Covenant, thinking about Deuteronomy 28 through 30, obviously talking about Israel, the people of the covenant. So there was no small amount of damage that was done at this time, as was indicated in the text. Then Antiochus again turned his attention back to Egypt, verses 29 to 30. So in this same year, Antiochus went back to wanting to attack Egypt, want to gain some more ground for himself, get some more political benefit. So he arrived there with his army, and he was confronted by a Roman consul, Papilius Lianus, who met him at Alexandria, Egypt, and then prevented him from invading Egypt. So he was not able to do what he wanted, as he had previously done in Egypt. And the reference to the ships of Kittim in some versions, or Cyprus, verse 30, that came against him, they belonged to Papilius Lianus and to Rome, and so that's who he was up against, and that's who was thwarting his interest in doing more damage in the southern kingdom of Egypt. So Antiochus had to return home, because if he thought he could stand up against the armies of the Romans, he would have been destroyed because Rome had gained enough power, he had lost enough strength that he would not have been able to defeat them. So he returned to Syria rather disappointed, and not surprisingly, he took out his frustration on the Jews in Jerusalem. And they are the ones who are recognized as observing the Holy Covenant, verse 28. And then Antiochus, he tended to favor those Jews who had abandoned the Mosaic law because they were more open to the Greek influence, the Hellenistic mindset. And 1 Maccabees 2:18 and 2 Maccabees 6:1 give an indication of that. And Menelaus and his people that were on his side, they were willing to abandon their religious scruples rather than oppose Antiochus because of the political benefit that they gained. So it was, again, political expediency. You drop what you would have normally stood for because you gain some particular benefit from it. So again, it's another example of someone changing their position for the political benefit. Not that anyone in our time would do that. If you think about it, that's been going on and just was in the news of recent time again. I think I just must have skipped one here, but let me just give it to you. Israel was again the brunt of unbridled opposition or oppression. Antiochus ordered his general, Apollonius, and a contingent of 22,000 soldiers into Jerusalem on what he claimed was a peaceful mission. However, when they were inside the city, they attacked the Jews on a Sabbath. Of course, the Jews are going to be reluctant to exert themselves on the Sabbath because that would be against their law. So in the process, Apollonius killed many Jews. He took Jewish women and children captive as slaves. He plundered the temple. He burned the city. And it was the objective of Antiochus here to exterminate Judaism because they wouldn't play along with him. They wouldn't go along with his desire to basically Hellenize the area, to make the area more Greek, to adopt the Greek culture. And he hated their resistant mindset. So consequently, he prohibited the Jews from following the Mosaic law. He did away with the Jewish sacrifices, their festivals, circumcision, again documented in 1 Maccabees 1:44 to 54. He even burned copies of their law. As accumulating measure, he installed an image of Zeus, his Greek god, in the temple and erected an altar to Zeus on the altar of burnt incense, or burnt offerings, rather. 2 Maccabees 6:2, and this, of course, was not the first time that such sacrilege had taken place because King Ahaz had set up an idolatrous altar, as did King Manasseh, as far as it's installing images of pagan gods. So that's, again, recognized in 2 Kings. But then Antiochus sacrificed a pig on the altar. And, of course, that's an unclean animal to the Jews that would have defiled the whole sacrificial place. And so then he ordered the Jews to sacrifice swine's flesh on the altar. This happened in December 16 of 168 B.C. The Jews refer to this act as the abomination that caused desolation, also referenced in 1211. Since it polluted their altar and made sacrifices to Yahweh on it impossible, this was a very serious infraction. That's why it used that strong of terminology. Antiochus further ordered his Jewish subjects to celebrate his subsequent birthdays by offering a pig to Zeus on his altar that had been so defiled. Now, what's interesting is that Jesus refers to a similar atrocity that's going to be taking place in the future using that same terminology, Matthew 24:15, Mark 13:14. Christ's explicit reference to the prophet Daniel as being the writer of this prophet or of this prophecy should be enough proof that Daniel was the author and wrote this book, and that it was prophetic in its significance. So when Jesus referred to this coming atrocity literally as the abomination that causes desolation, using the exact words that are found in Daniel's version in the Septuagint, it's recognizing that this is a real situation that took place, and it has significance for something future as well. Antiochus's actions were a preview of an atrocity that is yet to befall the Jews. The destruction of Jerusalem took place in AD 70 by the Roman emperor or the Roman general Titus. And so some would see that this was a fulfillment of this prediction. But Titus didn't treat the Jews as Antiochus did. In the book of Revelation, which was written later than the events of AD 70, also refer to an event as Abomination of Desolations. When you see that, that's indicating that it's not just looking back at the time of Antiochus, but Antiochus was prefiguring the events that are going to be coming under the Antichrist in the future. So Antiochus then becomes a type of this future man of sin, and his activities foreshadow the ultimate blasphemous persecution of Israel and the destruction of their temple. So just as Jesus had various previous saints to him that were types or prefigured him, so the Antichrist had a type of himself as well. So then looking at verses 32 and 33, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. So here we recognize manipulation and oppression will intensify. It's not going to get less, it's going to get more before it's all over. Antiochus used his skills to win over some of the Jews. He deceived many of them with his flattery and with his promises that they would gain some benefit if they cooperated with him. This is also noted in 1 Maccabees 1:11-15, so that they actually participated with him and they worshipped this Zeus. So there were those who went along with that. So he was obviously a master in manipulating the Jewish leaders at this time. Those who were divided in their loyalties, those who were kind of on the fence, not really committed to the Word of God, but open to other things around them. Of course, we don't have any of that today going on in our world, right? Unfortunately, that still continues. So he was able to win some of them over with his promises of preferred treatment, etc. So Antiochus already had various ones that were won over to his side, and he managed to convince them of the expediency of having a more Greek mindset, orientation, adopting that kind of thinking. And so he was capitalizing on that and trying to get more, because that was what his whole intention was. He wanted everybody unified under this same kind of thinking, and he was pushing toward that. So in some ways, this defection of those who would be considered the progressives, where have we heard that word before? The progressives among the Jews was even a more serious threat to the survival of Israel than some of the measures of Antiochus himself. So there's a danger in those who are supposed to be true to his word, who will capitulate in places where they ought not to. So it was the same kind of betrayal of their covenant obligations that put Israel into captivity in Babylon that was happening now many years later, some of the same kinds of responses that were going on. So these repulsive acts that Antiochus had been foisting on the people there is what was part of the precipitation or the preparation for the Maccabean revolt, where they finally are going to say, we've had enough, and they react to it. This was initiated by a priest by the name of Matthias from the town of Modin in Ephraim, and it was led by three of his sons, Judas, Jonathan, and Simon, also noted in 1 Maccabees 2:23-28. And so this more nationalistic movement would eventually overthrow the Seleucids in Palestine and remove that pressure on them, of course, only to be followed by Rome coming in and taking over. But they at least had some freedom or some element of independence for a time, even if it was a bit shaky. The word Maccabee in the Greek is the surname of Judas ben Matthias, or Judas son of Matthias, 1 Maccabees 2:4. The Jews applied this name basically to the whole family of the Matthias group, but also to the party that sort of, or the group that of those that were the resistance at this time. It's interesting, the word itself means hammer or eradicator, as in the Terminator. Of course, not to be confused with Arnold, the other Terminator, but that's the association that Judas Maccabeus had because of his resistance at this time. He was known for slaying the general of Antiochus, Apollonius, in battle. Of course, that was not particularly appreciated, so you can imagine there is going to be some retaliation in the process of some of that as well. He and his brothers also achieved other victories that ultimately led to freeing the Jews for a time of independence. It was kind of shaky on and off to some degree, but over a period of about 100 years. The actions of Antiochus impacted various responses. Antiochus's persecutions gave impetus to the Chassidim. They were the godly, the pious, the loyal ones. It was a movement that was already underway in Israel, but it intensified, it got more strong. And from that group that was more strict in terms of their adherence to the Mosaic Law and the traditions of Judaism, the strict Orthodox group that we hear of today, the Chassidim, came from them. Also coming from them would have been the group of the Pharisees. That was a sect that came from them, and also the isolationist Essene community in Qumran came from this group as well. So there were some variations that came about at this time as part of a resistance to the oppression that was going on. It kind of makes us think, well, maybe there's some of that kind of thing that we see or will see in events leading up to the times when the Antichrist is going to be in power in the tribulation period, which is yet significantly outside the parameters of our consideration at the moment. Then, looking at verses 34 and 35, now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue, and some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them. purify them and to make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So a national refining process continues. Now, if you think about the history of Israel for these past few hundred years up to this event, there had been a lot of refining going on. The prophets had come in and tried to steer them in the right direction. They eventually were taken into captivity, and then there was that refining process. They came back into the land. They were still having some issues, not all the same issues. And so this is, again, part of that refining process. But there's some observations we can gain here. One, the political environment is often misunderstood or misused. The godly in Israel received little encouragement from their apostate pro-Hellenistic brethren at first. Even the Maccabean revolt started out quite small, but as time went on and the Maccabees were more effective, and they saw some gains, then there were more Jews that tended to join their numbers, but some of them did so without abandoning their more pro-Hellenistic convictions, and then there was the problem of sort of a mixed multitude, if you will, and then the Maccabees were recognizing they needed to do some purging in their own ranks, and so there were some folks who lost their lives in that process as well. The refining process, as we know, is ongoing and not so pleasant, and I would simply want to indicate that I suspect that the church is in a refining process, or will be even more so in the future, and we have yet to see how that's going to exactly transpire. But anyway, during this time, there were various people who lost their lives in the struggle against the Syrians, and there was this purification that was going on. John Hyrcanus was the son of Simon Maccabeus. He founded a rather strong Jewish kingdom for a time. His son, Alexander Janneus, enlarged it to its fullest extent in the last part of the first century B.C. And so that gave some encouragement for a time. So as Daniel is recording this and recognizing that, I think he may have had some sense of realization that there would be predicted persecution that was going to be taking place, but it would eventually come to an end, and that this purification process, even though it wasn't complete, it would have a final ending in the future. Of course, there's going to be more detail on that given in a bit. So when we look at these amazingly detailed prophecies, as we take historical events and superimpose them sort of above the text and see how these things have filled out, we see there was approximately 135 prophetic statements in these first 35 verses. That's a lot of things that are noted there that have been fulfilled quite literally and specifically. And then there are other things that have yet to be fulfilled, so that gives us an idea that they will be fulfilled in the future in a specific way, as the previous ones had as well. So we want to recognize that reality. So what we want to see as we wrap this up is that these details were given for Daniel's benefit, for the people of Daniel's day, for our benefit, to see that God has spoken on the matter. He knew what was coming. He indicated the emphasis is moving toward a particular direction. And we need to take him at his word and to accept it, to live by his word day by day, to take him seriously. It's interesting that the Lord used a despicable person like Antiochus Epiphanes to accomplish his will. And he is the precursor of another despicable person who is yet to come. And this despicable person that was the precursor, he would precede the Messiah's first coming as he comes as the suffering Savior. And there's another despicable person who will precede the Messiah's second coming when he comes as the conquering king. And if we see that kind of timing, focus, element, I think it helps us to recognize how things are moving toward a particular ultimate end. But also we want to recognize that as we think about Antiochus, he was sort of the one who brought refinement and definition to the things that were coming, all in preparation for the Messiah's coming, as he came as the suffering Savior to die on the cross and pay the penalty for our sin. And we today have the opportunity to look back at this history and see all these things working toward a particular focus and those things that yet have to come to pass. And so today we have opportunity to celebrate that provision that was made available through Christ's first coming.